Dr. George Kolodner developed the IOP, intensive outpatient method, and also started the Colmack Clinic. The name is based on his name, Dr. George Kolodner, who is a medical doctor and brought medicine such as Antabuse and naltrexone and a medical approach to recovery. The MAC in Colmack was his name was McCarthy, a 12-step advocate. And it was a program that combined both the clinical, medical, and support group of AA fellowship. And it worked for me, I'll just say that. And I'm very grateful to these two gentlemen. We will start with Dr. George Kolodner, who is the Chief Innovative Officer and the founder of the Colmack Outpatient Clinics.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Greg. I'm really grateful to Greg for having invited me to speak here today, and I want to thank you all for attending. I'm going to talk to you about some of the ways that I've been working as a physician to help people recover from addictions. 50 years ago, I wouldn't have expected to be talking to you on this subject. Back then, I was in the middle of my medical training, and like most doctors at that time, and unfortunately, still to this day, I'd never knowingly encountered anyone who had recovered from an alcohol problem. Based on the teachings of my supervisors and as well as my own observation, I believe that anybody struggling with such a problem had a very poor prognosis. I therefore wasn't prepared for what I saw when I completed my training and began a 2-year medical tour of duty in the Navy. Several years before my tour, a group of people in the Navy who were in recovery from alcohol problems had convinced people in Navy leadership that when sailors were no longer able to perform their duties at a high level because of their alcohol problem, helping them recover and retaining them in the Navy would be preferable to administratively discharging them, which had been the practice until that time. As a result, the Navy installed treatment programs for active duty enlisted men with alcohol problems in a few naval hospitals. And I was fortunate enough to be assigned to one of those hospitals located in Bethesda. It's now known as Walter Reed. Back then it was known as Bethesda Naval Hospital. I was not assigned to staff the program, but I was working in another ward. But I saw people getting better, and I'd never seen that before. And I was intrigued by what I saw. And what I did was to adopt as a mentor the lead counselor of the program, who himself was in recovery. What the Navy had installed was something known and still known as the Minnesota Residential Model. It's a treatment approach that's based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I left the Navy and returned to the civilian world, I saw employed people with alcohol problems who, unlike the sailors, they couldn't access residential treatment. They couldn't get the time off. The insurance didn't cover residential treatment. And I decided, since I now knew that folks with alcohol problems could get better, I decided to try to take what I had seen in the residential model and try to create an analogous model that could be accessed more easily. One problem is that even though I now knew people could get better, I knew nothing about alcoholism. In fact, the first publication I ever wrote was in the AA Grapevine, where I described that I didn't understand alcoholism. But the good news is that I started going to AA meetings, where I met people in long-term recovery, and I began to talk about my interest in developing an alternative model of treatment. And I was impressed with how warmly I was received and how many people in recovery came my way to try to help me. And many of these people were already in the treatment field or in the employment field. They began teaching me about the problem and recovery. And specifically, one of them introduced me to Jim McMahon, who Greg had referred to, was he actually had been the head of the Navy program that interested me so much. He had, when I left the Navy, he was a career officer. He coincidentally left the Navy. We bumped into each other as I was planning this program. And when he heard what I had in mind, he joined up with me. He came to work with me, and we founded the program that I later named after ourselves. And the reason I did that was, this was back in the early 70s. There really was a lot of tension, almost a cold war, between degreed professionals such as myself, who had never seen an alcoholic get better, and alcoholic people like Jim, who were counselors, who had really been not treated so well by the medical profession, and therefore had some suspicions about people with doctors with degrees. And what we tried to say was, if we could work together, and these two groups could work together, we could learn from each other, and everybody could benefit. So he became my primary mentor about addictions, and I became his mentor about mental health issues, because my background was as a psychiatrist. And we started designing the program. The problem was, we couldn't find a program that had done what we wanted to do. So we had to start with the residential model, and had to ask myself, what was it about the residential component of the treatment program that was so therapeutic? I became impressed that what was therapeutic about it was the environment that was created in the residential setting, because there were essentially no medications given beyond withdrawal, and there was no individual therapy looking for the kind of underlying psychological causes that I had been taught by my supervisors was probably what was a road to recovery, that turned out really not to be a road to recovery. The notion that the environment, as opposed to medication or individual therapy, could be therapeutic was consistent with what I had learned in working with hospitalized psychiatric patients. And I realized from the little contact I had with AA at that point that it was consistent with recovery in AA, that as I saw it, what happened to people who were trying to recover is that they would become immersed in a knowledgeable, caring community that would create a therapeutic environment. As I began to try to develop this new treatment approach, I met with very deep skepticism from others in the treatment community about an outpatient approach. What I would hear over and over again is that to have the best chance of recovery, you needed to remove yourself entirely from your day-to-day life and focus 24/7 on recovery. But what I noticed was there were lots of people who had been recovering in AA for years while they were still in their environment. We also found that there were some benefit in this outpatient setting to people learning real life lessons while they were living in their own home and work environment, so they could begin to apply these issues immediately rather than be in a remote setting and then later go back and try to apply it. While they were trying to learn these lessons and apply them in our setting, they had us, their clinicians, right there with them each day, helping to adjust their changes that they had to make if they were going to live life in a sober way. The other thing we found was that a residential program, you were either in it or out of it. It was 24/7, but then it was zero. But with our outpatient program, we could have people start very intensively, and our initial pace is five times a week. They come Monday through Friday for 3 hours. And then as people would stabilize and progress, we could gradually ease them back into their own, their regular schedule by reducing the frequency of their treatment. So there was not an abrupt reentry problem, which is the case with residential treatment. The other thing that we did had to do with AA. Now remember, AA was the heart of the residential Minnesota model, in which people work typically the first four steps, and they're required to go to meetings on a daily basis. Jim, who had recovered in AA, had a deep respect for the traditions of AA, and his opinion was that even though people would get better with this approach, he felt that there was a violation of AA traditions to, number one, force people to go to meetings, and number two, to charge people money to basically work the steps. So our goal was clearly to get people to AA, but we didn't go over the steps in our program. We used psychotherapy approaches, and we looked at other issues around the kind of changes that people would have to make in their lives, both physically and psychologically, if they were going to dramatically change it and stop drinking. So the paradox is that we were at first, and for some years, cast as anti-AA because we weren't requiring people to go and we didn't work the steps. Over time, that label dissolved because we were taking what I thought was a softer approach, a less direct approach. And as our graduates began to fill up AA meetings in our community, it was clear that we were very supportive of AA, and that label I think has gone by the boards. There are questions I can maybe ask specific, but I won't go through the details of our program. But what we did was we set out to set up an alternative for people who could not get away from work or home obligations. But in the process, we created a whole new treatment system that really had three levels of care. First is withdrawal management for people who, or it's commonly known as detoxification, for people who were physically dependent and needed to be received medication to be safely and comfortably transitioned out of their physical dependence. Then we had the outpatient rehab program, followed by a continued care program that was a step down of once a week treatment that people could stay in for months or years if necessary, while they ultimately transitioned into the recovery community. What I've now come to believe is that there's some real advantages for this model over the traditional model, which still is the dominant model of treatment, wherein people go into a hospital or a treatment center to receive withdrawal management. Then they go into a residential rehab, and then they return to the community. That's an inherently fragmented system. And in that fragmentation, number one, it's more difficult to access. And number two, people tend to stop treatment prematurely. And when they stop treatment prematurely, especially if they don't go to any follow-up treatment after withdrawal management, the relapse rate is unacceptably high. So I've come to believe that this outpatient three-level model that we've designed is much more appropriate for a chronic, incurable disease such as what we now call alcohol use disorder. The last thing I wanted to say was talk a little bit about the adjustments we've made with COVID. What we've done with COVID is we've pivoted from an in-person program, which we're now starting our 48th year. Within a couple days, we were able to transition entirely to a telehealth format using the same Zoom tool that we're using right now. previously we were interested in doing it, and we had actually installed the infrastructure and begun to use it, and we were unable to develop it because of a web of state and federal regulations and insurance restrictions, which when COVID, when the pandemic began, all those restrictions were rapidly dropped. These were restrictions which we had, people had worked for years to try to get relaxed and weren't very successful, but they were fortunately dramatically dropped. And that's allowed us and other programs to do the work that we used to do in person, but to do it in this kind of a video setting. I'm gonna just say a couple words about the part that I've been most focused on, which is withdrawal management. That's something, outpatient withdrawal management is something that I had been doing for almost 50 years. It still is not as popular as outpatient rehab, the IOP, but it was clearly effective and safe. And what I've now done is to figure out a way to do this virtually. And since mid-March, when we started doing it, we've treated over 300 people for alcohol and other drugs. We've done withdrawal management. And what is so gratifying to me is that we are getting the same outcomes that we did when we're doing this in person. About 90% of the people who start with us complete the withdrawal management. And of the ones that complete it, about 90% go into follow-up care in our IOP. And just for comparison's sake, if you look at the number of people who receive withdrawal management in hospitals, the number that go into treatment after follow-up treatment are somewhere between 20% and 50%, a far cry from 90%. So I think that's a strong argument for the benefit of doing this on an outpatient basis. Before I stop, I just want to comment something that you probably all familiar with, is that AA itself has also discovered the advantage of these kind of online meetings. And from what I'm hearing from my patients, they are finding them so beneficial that they hope to continue these after the pandemic is over. For us, the big question is, once the pandemic is over, are all those regulations that were in place before the pandemic, are they going to be snapped back, so to speak? And all the advances that we've learned the telehealth can do, that we're going to lose those. That would be very sad. I hope that won't happen, but only time will tell. So I think we may have time for questions before Brian does his part of the presentation.
I was very impressed by the fact that when I was one of your clients or patients, that there was a one night a week that you spent educating family members, which I think is very important for alcoholics, that the people around them understand what they're going through. What is that still part of your program?
That's an essential part of our program. And that's, again, part of our easier access for people. You want to involve the family members. If you are geographically remote, then that's a bit of a problem. The residential programs do try to address that by typically having a week or a weekend when the family members come up there. But we try to get the family members to come in every week for a family support group and also be available for conjoint sessions with the staff, individual staff member when that's appropriate. So yeah, that's a critical piece. We are not successful in getting the family in as frequently as we would like, both because of resistance on the patient side and resistance on the family side. There's so much, as you know, animosity and distrust when by the time people get into treatment. But we do everything we can to get the family members in, and also to get them engaged in Al-Anon and Nar-Anon, which we think is really critical for both their recovery and it's beneficial to our patients.
Yeah, I'm Sri. I have a question for the doctor. You know, more and more treatment programs are including body work and physical components as opposed to just talk therapy. Does your program include any of that, like exercise, yoga, tai chi, any of that stuff?
I highly value what are called ancillary approaches. And I believe that some things work for a lot of people, and there are other things that work for a few people. The more things we can offer to folks, it's like a cafeteria. Try this out, and if it's helpful, hold on to it. And we have had yoga, meditation, all kinds of other supportive issues. Because we're not residential, and our people are working all day, typically, coming to us for 3 hours, then hurrying home for dinner, and to get to bed and to work the next day, there's been a limit on how much, for example, body work that we could do, but we certainly support people doing that outside the treatment hours. Talk, I agree, talk alone is not enough for most people.
For those who would like to learn more about the COLMAC Outpatient Recovery Centers, colmac.com is their website, and they have several, not only in Washington, D.C., where I was fortunate to go, but all around the D.C. area. And they've just opened or about did a ribbon cutting in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, I believe.
That's right. That's right. Our model of IOP has been accepted and embraced across the country, but I've been disturbed that it's been in a diluted form. And I think that people don't understand just how effective it can be. So we made the decision to take our version of it out to other areas, and we're starting to spread outside the Maryland, D.C. area. There are lots of questions in there, and I can try to respond to them at some point, but I don't want to cut into Brian's time. So
why don't we let Brian go ahead and speak? And Dr. Kolodner, if you can take a minute and look through some of the questions, then we'll have questions for both of you when Brian's finished. Does that work? Hi, Brian.
That's great.
Hello, everybody.
Brian Gill, he is the clinical director of the COLMAC Outpatient Recovery Centers.
Hello. Thanks for having us. I'm the clinical director at the DC office. First, I want to say I've been looking at the questions you have. You guys are an intelligent crowd. I see websites being shared on outcome studies and all kinds of cool things. I also want to say until Greg asked me to speak, I'd not heard of ICSA, which I feel embarrassed about, since a big objection to our patients is that they have to go to AA. They don't have to, but there's so few options. And to know that there's a whole secular organization out here and that I didn't know about it is embarrassing. I've been in the field for 30 years, so I'm still learning. What I'm going to speak about today is how to stay sober in a virtual world. And if you want to know the short version of my lecture, it would be keep doing what you're doing. What I'm going to do is share a PowerPoint and kind of zip through it. And then I'd like to welcome people to participate and share their own experience. I don't want to pass up the opportunity for you all to share. So let me give you just some facts and figures and data, and then we'll hear from everybody here. So that's me. I'm Brian Gill. We're going to talk about sobriety in a virtual world, the effects of social isolation on recovery. So this is the geeky part of the conference. I think we all know what social isolation is, basically because people in addiction often have already been isolating and we don't need a pandemic to do that. It basically means you're alone, you participate minimally in life, and you have little or infrequent contact with valued people in your life. And of course, this is also a hallmark of substance abuse as we slowly retreat from social activities and spend more and more time in our fuzzy world of getting high. When a person is isolating, there are physical, emotional, and cognitive effects, and you may really relate to some. In fact, many people seek counseling not because they have an addiction, but because they're suffering one of these other things. So there's sleep difficulty, people have increased illness, people either go through weight gain or lose weight. And often people lapse into unhealthy routines. They give up healthy activities and find themselves being sedentary and lacking motivation. That's because emotionally, with increased isolation comes along anxiety, and depression. We feel helpless, which impacts our self-esteem. And of course, as most people know, we begin to feel more and more stress in solitary confinement. In fact, a very common form of torture is to put people in a cell all by themselves and deny them human interaction. As humans, we're social creatures. And even if you're a profound introvert, you may like going to a restaurant and sitting alone, but you'd like other people to be in the restaurant rather than it be empty because nobody's there. There's some cognitive effects with social isolation. You become increasingly bored. You have a decline in rational thought, meaning you start worrying more. You start awfulizing. Some people call it future tripping. You may have difficulty concentrating. You have a sense of lethargy and inertia. So even if you have the time to do things, like you've always wanted to learn guitar or learn a new language and watching YouTube videos or Netflix reruns, and not grabbing that time to do something productive. And an interesting thing with COVID is we lose track of time, where days kind of blend into one another, where we don't have those natural divisions of getting in the car and going to work and then coming home and going to sleep and getting up the next day and knowing when it's the weekend and when it's a weekday. There's some research that's already been done this early in the pandemic. The Kaiser Family Foundation interviewed adults back in March, asking what their anxiety and stress level was like. And 32% of the adults interviewed said their stress was higher than usual. But by July, that figure had climbed to 53%. So over half the population in the United States admittedly reports increased levels of stress. 36% of adults said they had difficulty sleeping. 32% found eating problems. 12% reported increases in substance use. Also, the Kaiser Family Foundation monitor monthly what the level of the general population, and as of last year in 2019, for the period of January through June, approximately one out of every 10 adults in America reported having anxiety and depression. In May of this year, it went to 34.5%. In June, it climbed to 36.5%. As of the last reporting time, July, 40% of adults were reporting anxiety and depression. So as you can tell, if you're feeling any of this, then you're guilty of being normal, because it's normal during a pandemic to have these feelings. There's also an effect on youth. About 1,000 participants, age 18 through 35, about 50% found themselves feeling a heightened sense of loneliness. 80% had significant depression, 60% increased anxiety, 30% admitted harmful levels of drinking, and of the 250 or so that admitted using drugs, 38% of that group said their drug use had become severe. Now, we already know as substance abusers that how to isolate. We're experts at it. We can isolate in a crowd of people so that nobody knows what's going on in us. We do that to avoid conflict and to hide our own shame. And of course, because we've been trading social relationships for substance abuse. There's a difference with COVID. So two of the questions we will ask ourselves throughout our life is, who am I and how do I do it? The moment we're born into our family, we want to know, who am I in this family and how do I do it? And then as a teenager, we want to know how we fit into our friend group. And in our work life, we want to know, who am I and how do I do this? Then we get married and we have to figure out what's it like to be a spouse. And then we have kids and we have to figure out what it's like to be a parent. Then our kids become teenagers and we have to figure out what it's like to be a parent all over again. Then they leave home and we have to figure out what it's like to be with somebody without kids in the house. And each time we have these changes, we have an existential crisis. We have to figure out, who am I and how do I do it? But with the pandemic, everything changed within a few days, and the entire earth had to figure out, who am I during this pandemic and how am I supposed to do it? And there was no book sitting on a shelf like there are for parents or for newlyweds or for people who are unemployed saying how to get through this time. We don't have a handy self-help bookshelf on how to survive a pandemic. And so people started wondering, who am I and how do I do it? And they went to people like therapists, and we're like, we don't know. We're in the same boat. We're trying to figure out, who am I and how do I do it? And so everybody descended into this lovely existential crisis of, how do I stay sane in an insane world? So people survive existential crises by building resiliency. And if you think of resiliency like a spring where you can bend with the stress and you can bounce back, for us to be resilient, the qualities we often think of for resiliency are optimism, a sense of competence that I know what I'm doing or I know I can handle this, having some hope, feeling gratitude, and having a sense of compassion. And we're just going to look at some ways we can do that. And then what I'd like us to do is share ways we've coped as a group during this pandemic. And I'm kind of preaching to the choir because the fact that you are here shows you already are being resourceful versus all the people that probably need to be here that feel like, well, what's the use of joining somebody in Zoom? It's not the same as real life, and they don't realize what they're missing. So recovery about substance abuse has usually been about connection. Even in the pandemic, we find going to virtual meetings can be a help. And one way virtual meetings can be helpful if you haven't yet is learning to text people that you hear comment. I've noticed some of you are making text even as the speakers speak. That's a way for you to feel a part of rather than just sitting and watching Zoom and feeling bored or turning off your screen and doing something else, that by commenting and sharing, you stay engaged. Let people know you're new. Another way to connect is using meditation apps that also show you other people who are meditating at the same time. A secret to 12-step recovery that's unique, I think, to 12-step is that of service work. If you've ever gotten a medallion, it usually has recovery, unity, and service on the back. You know, you come to a place like Colmec and we do great work. I mean, I truly believe it. I've worked at several different treatment centers and I love them all. But all we do is help you examine your life. The secret of AA is they say, look at the person next to you and see what you can do to help their life. So getting out of yourself and being involved with other people is another way to have a sense of connection and have a sense of hope. There are some techniques we can use to be able to cope during a crisis. One is to avoid sugar and fatty foods. You know, one of the things your body wants to do is to store calories during a crisis. Even though we're not in that kind of a crisis, your body is pretty primal and it just goes to what it knows. So being careful of sugar and fatty foods. Another place to be careful with and to kind of put yourself on a diet is with news. Some of us obsessively follow tracking with COVID, and in a study done in Iraq, they found the people most depressed were the people who obsessed with following COVID on Facebook. We talked about stagnation, and stagnation is another way that we find in COVID we want to lay around all the time and we find it difficult to move. And so making sure you're staying active and not becoming a couch potato and forgetting to leave the house is important. There's a term we use in therapy, and it's called regression in the service of the ego. And basically what that means is when people go through rough times, they often go backwards. And right now, especially with COVID, we have to be careful that we don't regress in our recovery and go back to an earlier time. We worked hard to where we got, and we want to maintain it. And finally, there's something called cognitive distortions, and those are negative beliefs that we view the world through. I like to call them the itty-bitty shitty committee. And when we're in our head, along with that itty-bitty shitty committee, we can paint such a dark picture that we become hopeless. And it's like looking at life through a paper towel tube, and we feel like we can't see anything but a bleak future, and we forget that this too shall pass, and things will eventually return to normal. So here are some things that I've learned from my clients and from my own observations that help right now. And then I'd love to hear from you all. One is just breathe. It can be for 15 seconds to just take some time and close your eyes and repeat whatever your favorite mantra is. This too shall pass, or, you know, I'll be okay, or I'm not alone. But just breathing for 15 to 20 seconds. The three faithful things that help in coping with stress is diet, rest, and exercise. And by diet, I mean just add vegetables to whatever you're eating and try to lay off the ice cream and the sugar. Be creative with your connection, even if it means just going for a walk and being near people outside, you know, keeping it safe, but not staying inside all day. There was a study done about gratitude. You know, you hear in the program, sometimes people will say, keep a gratitude list, which is kind of cliche and cheesy. but actually in any study done on gratitude lists, people who consistently write down what they're grateful for tend to be optimistic and have a sense of hopefulness for the future. Be of service to other people. Worry about somebody else for a bit and not yourself will give you a sense of competence and mastery and a sense of like you're doing something productive versus just a sitting and worrying. And finally, the last thing would be just give yourself time. That we're in the middle of a crisis and we're all new at this and there is no roadmap and we're creating it as we go along. And much like how AA was founded, people shared their experience, strength, and hope to figure it out. So I'm curious, we have a few minutes, and I'm wondering what you all have learned in dealing with your sobriety and with suddenly being in isolation, how you all have found yourselves coping during this crisis. And I would say feel free to unmute yourself, or and Joe, if you have control over that, that's or Greg, that's fine, so that that other people can share either what your challenges have been, because I can say it's, you know, do these things, but some of you are single parents where it's like, I can't get away from the house for 5 seconds because I have, you know, three kids waiting for me. Some of you are trying to work with other people in the home and don't have privacy that you normally are used to. So I'm curious how you all have found yourself coping.
And quickly, Brian, are you willing to share your slides since we didn't get to see the end of them?
I am. I don't know what happened, but I was afraid it said Zoom wants to close, and I didn't want that to happen, so I just stopped it all.
If you will email those to me at your convenience, I'll make sure that anyone who wants a copy gets them, if that's all right with you.
Absolutely.
We have about 15 minutes for questions for Dr. Kolodner or for Brian Gill. Are you Dr. Gill? Should I be calling you Dr.?
I'm a licensed clinical social worker.
Okay. I did see a question for Dr. Kolodner about just what does your IOP consist of? I know it's 3 hours. Can you summarize it quickly?
Group therapy is really the heart of the most effective part of treatment for addictions. And we talk about psychoeducational groups because there is some information passed during some of the sessions, whereas there are also traditional group therapy for other sessions. So we would do three groups back to back. And most people come to us not because of groups, but despite groups. It's about the last thing. If you ask somebody with an alcohol problem what they would like, they say, I'd like some medication, some individual treatment. Group is what we offer, not because people ask for it, but because it seems to be most effective. And there was another question about cognitive distortions. Within the addiction world, using cognitive behavioral therapy has become our primary language. When I started off, there was AA language and there was psychoanalytic language. Psychoanalytic language has not been that helpful, but cognitive behavioral has been, and a lot of that is really, there's a lot of cognitive behavioral issues buried in AA. So for example, the phrase cognitive distortions refers to thoughts that have some degree of accuracy, but are also distorted in ways that lead to maladaptive behavior. And AA for decades has talked about stinking thinking. And that's really, I think, the common word for cognitive distortions. And we do integrate medication when it's useful. One of the questions that came was from someone who found medications completely useless. And that's the experience that some people have. Other people find that medications are a game changer. The trouble is we don't know ahead of time who will benefit and who will not. So right now we're still stuck with trial and error, but there are genetic advances being done. I'm told, I haven't seen the studies yet, at a reputable place like the Mayo Clinic or Hazleton, which has always been a residential program that I've highly respected, where they're doing a genetic testing that will allow them, physicians, to identify which medications the person is more likely to respond to, so that we don't have to do this by trial and error. There was another question about time and treatment and success. And in general, the general rule of thumb is the longer people stay in treatment, the better they do. And that, again, is consistent with what is heard in AA so often, of just keep coming back. Perseverance has an enormous positive effectiveness on successful treatment. So those are some of the questions I saw come through.
I Jeff, alcoholic, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you have any specific part of your program that specifically addresses cognitive distortions? In other words, do you teach any there are tools available to determine whether you're in the midst of a cognitive distortion or not? I'm sure you're familiar with them, but there's virtually no research done into cognitive distortions and alcoholism, and in particular, something I feel is very important, the role of cognitive distortions in long-term relapse. In other words, why people relapse after long periods of sobriety, years of sobriety, somebody has 7 years of sobriety and will suddenly start drinking again, pick up again, if they're, using a drug or something. I think that there should be some research into whether that's tied to cognitive distortions or not. I've been talking with a professor at USC, Jeffrey Gunter. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. He's got a whole hypothesis on something akin to cognitive distortions. He posits the existence of a guardian, which is a part of the brain he hypothesizes triggers autonomic responses that occur without cognitive awareness, similar to cognitive distortions. Don't you think it cheapens the whole importance of the issue by just degrading it by calling it stinking thinking? I mean, to me, it seems that this is the thing that is the most threatening to long-term sobriety, and they don't teach you about it in rehab, and it's really not mentioned per se as a psychological phenomenon in the big book. I understand cognitive science is new, but could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I wouldn't say stinking thinking degrades the idea. I think that there's a really punchy wisdom in AA that I think gets to the point very quickly in terms of research. Cognitive behavioral treatment, CBT, CBT was really instigated by Aaron Beck and his group in Philadelphia. They were pretty evidence-based. And if you read their material, it rises to the level of research. They cut their teeth on anxiety and depression. And then they took that method that seemed to work so well there and applied it to substance use disorders. And they wrote a book about it, about 15, 20 years ago. And I thought that they, plus a man named Alan Marlatt, who doesn't get as much credit as he should, he's a West Coast guy, really laid out how to use those concepts. And on our website, we have something that I put called a relapse sequence, where I took Beck's diagram of how relapses occur using cognitive behavioral language. I had taken his diagrams and I'd showed it to our patients, and they looked at that and they would say to me, well, that's almost right, but we really some adjustments that you have to do, because what Beck tried to do was to squeeze addictions into a model that worked well for depression and anxiety. A little bit of tweaking, it is very applicable to addiction. So, and what we do with that, in terms of people asking, what do we do with our program? When someone relapses, and sometimes they do relapse because our folks go home every night, we would use this relapse sequence as a tool to analyze how that relapse occurred and bring about an awareness that often the person didn't have before. Because typically when people come into us with a relapse, they say, I don't know what happened. I was doing so well. And then bam, all of a sudden out of nowhere came this relapse. But if you use this kind of a diagram, you can slow the process down and start asking, okay, just before you took that drink, what were you doing? Where were you? How were you feeling? And almost in a frame by frame replay of a video, they begin to be aware of what was going on. And if you can slow down the process, they can learn what the prelude was to that. Because what we often say with relapses is relapse is a multi-stage process, and the actual use is often the seventh or eighth step in that process. If you can get sensitized to what we call the early warning signs and recognize them when they're at the first or second or third step, then you can intervene and keep that process from cascading down into an actual use. And that's, again, I think, something that AA has pioneered in, you know, that people find that when they're cravings, they're instructed to, you know, call your sponsor, call somebody. Don't just sit there and try to grit your teeth, because being in isolation is the one thing that's going to accelerate that that relapse process.
I'm going to cut off the questions here. I'm sorry. You're welcome to go to the green room or the lounge if you want. This room is going to be used for an AA history panel. You're welcome to stay. The other room is going to be a speaker on fetal alcohol syndrome. So with that, I'm saying goodbye and thank you, Dr. Kolodner and Brian Gill.
Thank you for having us.